Is she there? Okay. Well, well, well. Hello, hello. We had a little trouble starting. My mic would not work. Well, anyway, here we are. This is Lead Stories. You just heard the World Saxophone Quartet performing Hamiet Blewett's I Heard That, recorded in 1988. Blewett's on baritone, Julius Hemphill and Oliver Lake on altos, and David Murray on tenor. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Wednesday, March the 12th. And we return to a case we've been following for some time now, and it has reached the point where we need to talk about what happened after the trial and the legal issues that have been raised and are being dealt with. Just to recap, the case is about a group called the IRP6. They are six executives of a small software company in Colorado City, Colorado, who had developed a software solution that had use and application in the law enforcement community. It helped different agencies. It would help different law enforcement agencies be on the same page, essentially, in handling their casework. And without warning, 21 armed Federal Bureau of Investigation agents showed up at their place of business in a raid under a warrant searching for evidence of, they said, fraud. And they removed a number of things, just boxes of stuff, including software stuff, computers, and so forth. And inevitably, it ended up as being part of an indictment sometime later on a 24-page warrant charging them that with doing business as a fraudulent company. They went to trial. It was a most unusual trial, as we discussed here. Very strange things were happening at this trial. And were convicted, all of them, facing sentences of up to 11 years, and in fact, they are in prison currently. Well, of course, the effort is to appeal the case, and in the appeals, that we see there, too, some very strange things happening. We will be talking with Gwendolyn Solomon, a co-counsel with Mark Garagos, in handling the appeals. And she explains that in many ways the IRP6 were denied a fair trial and they were railroaded into their sentences. And I thank her for being with us today. Thank you so much, Gwendolyn, for being today with us today. Sorry.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Could you talk about what the challenges were as you entered the case with respect to appeals?
Right now, the case is on appeal, as you stated. The issues that are being addressed are the speedy trial. They violated the guy's speedy trial rights. There were several continuances where you're supposed to have a trial within 70 days, and there were some ends of justice continuances, and some of them that were not followed through the procedure of ends of justice, and that violated their to have the gentleman come before and have a speedy trial. There were also issues of the Fifth Amendment, where they violated the guy's Fifth Amendment rights, the right against self-incrimination. One of the, they coerced one of the defendants to testify. They also violated the Sixth Amendment rights, which was a right against to have a fair trial. And then they also, one of the big issues is the transcript is missing, which had played a major part in the proceedings of displaying how that the guy's Fifth Amendment rights were denied. And it's, we're talking about 200 unedited pages of transcript. Normally in that situation, of course, from what my experience and from what I've heard through other attorneys, a case would be dismissed on those bases that the proceedings were missing, and you would either be having a new trial or, like I said, the charges would be dismissed. One of the other issues that we have on appeal is the denial of expert witnesses. There were two expert witnesses, Andrew Abarelli and Kelly Bauckham, that were owner. Mr. Abarelli was the owner of the staffing agency, and he was denied to testify in regards to how a staffing agency works, the risk that they take in contracting with the client, the different Dun & Bradstreet evaluations that are done prior to obtaining a client. Those considerations were, and his testimony would have been very critical to allowing the jury to see how a staffing agency works with a client. But because of his testimony was not allowed, then that's another major part of the appeal. And additionally, Kelly Bauckham was able to, she would be able to testify as to how staffing agencies staff people and how they get paid. So those are the issues right now that we have on appeal. We filed several motions and motions for reconsideration for the guys for bond pending appeal. We filed them before the district court and the 10th Circuit, and they've all been denied. And, you know, the basis, some of the basis just for allowing a bond pending appeal would be that the guys are not, you know, they would not have any tendency to flee, which they did prove that in the motions, but the court did not take those into consideration strongly. So those are things that we have concern about there as well. I'm showing that as far as when I've reviewed the transcripts, that they've never committed any mail fraud and wire fraud. The government never proved during the trial from the evidence that they made any false transactions through the mail or wire. The staffing agencies never even reported or testified that they ever received a false timesheet or anything like that. And then there were several companies, they were trying to say, the government was trying to state that the gentleman had a scam going on with false software, but there was an agent that came in, and I think he was a forensic expert in software, and he proved that the software was valid and it was a viable software. So and that was never allowed to be presented before the jury as well. Well, if you have a valid product, how can you be considered fraudulent?
In your years as an attorney, when you came to the case, did you expect to find these irregularities and aberrations in the trial being committed wholesale in the federal court?
Never expected some of the things that happened. I was even present. I did come in at the time of appeal, but I was present some of the days during the actual trial, and some of the things that I saw that were taking place with the prosecution and with the judge, I just could not believe how some of the evidence was not allowed to be, that the judge would not allow some of the evidence to be admitted. But all of the evidence was admitted for the government, and there was just so many irregularities, like I said, with the Fifth Amendment violations and so forth. Those things were just, it was like almost everything was not for the benefit of the defendant, which is supposed to be proven by the government, but everything was for the benefit of the government. Even evidence was admitted that wasn't even relevant to the case. So, yes, I was totally, in my experience, surprised by the handling of the matters, you know, during the judicial process of this case.
Is it normal that a case would take so long to be reviewed and to be decided on?
Well, what I was informed in Colorado, I was informed that Colorado has a quick turnaround. The guys have been incarcerated for 18 months. The case went in. I think we filed all of our documents, our brief, the government filed their brief and responses. I think everything went in by March of 2013. And I'm not showing that there has been a quick turnaround in our case. And like I said, with the missing transcript, a major part, 200 pages of missing transcript, unedited, a major part of the case with the violation of the Fifth Amendment rights. I've even been advised by other attorneys that there should have been a quick decision with that because the information is missing. So I'm very concerned about that, that we haven't had the case decision released. And then also there has been research done from cases that have started during the same period as my clients, and their decisions have been had a quick turnaround in decision. And to me, in review of that, and those issues that were presented in those cases, where some of them were just as possibly complex as they allege was in our case, but the decisions have already come back, and our decision has not come back yet. So that's very highly unusual. With missing transcripts that the decision has not come back yet.
Well, I know as an attorney you're going to be quite clinical about things. I mean, you deal with facts and not emotion. But in this case, do you find that the conduct of the judge, the conduct of the prosecutor, basically above board, or do you find that there is reason here for the charge of prosecutorial and judicial misconduct?
I can't address that issue. I do, like I said, I found discrepancies with the judge as far as not allowing evidence to be admitted and with the prosecutor. I do believe that they have gone outside of their scope of what they were supposed to do, and they have not proven, according to everything that I've reviewed, they have not proven their case. And I don't understand how the guys could be incarcerated when you're supposed to prove a case beyond reasonable doubt. And because of some of the evidence that the judge did not allow in the case, which was exculpatory evidence upon my review, if that evidence had been submitted to the jury during the deliberation, I don't believe that the verdict would have came back as guilty if everything had been submitted, if the guys had been able to submit all of their evidence.
Well, thank you very much, Gwendolyn. I know you are very, very busy, and I'm grateful that you were able to take this time to be with us to explain the appeals process and where things stand at that level. Thank you so much for being with us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Joining us now are two familiar voices, at least they should be familiar because we've been together doing these programs for a while. Sam Thurman, who is president of a group called A Just Cause, and Cliff Stewart, also with A Just Cause. Both Sam Thurman and Cliff Stewart are very much familiar with the men who have been incarcerated and who are on appeal right now with the case because they worked together at IRP. And they have taken this case up precisely because of the irregularities in this case on just about every single level from the start. They are advocating through A Just Cause that the convictions be overturned, that the men be released, and that there be a full federal investigation into all aspects of this case and the conduct of all major parties in this case. Thank you so much, Sam and Cliff, for being with us today.
Hi, you, Teresa. How are you doing today?
Fine, thank you. I had a little bit of mic trouble, but I'm okay now.
Thanks for having us again.
Thank you so much. Well, let's start with Sam. Could you talk about your observations about the appeals process as it stands?
Well, as it stands right now, you know, it is a very slow process. And one of the concerns that we have is the fact that in the 10th Circuit of Federal Court of Appeals, there is no timeline whereby the Court of Appeals has to make a ruling. Now, that being said, Over the last couple of weeks, Eutrice, we have come into the knowledge of some very critical information, and I would almost call it exciting news to be announced on your show today. One of the members of A Just Cause, Ms. Ethel Lopez, actually, as part of a Just Cause investigation into this thing, called one of the appellate judges, Judge Hartz, who is in New Mexico. She actually reached the judge's chambers and ended up having to leave a message. The judge called her back. Now, that in and of itself, Eutrice, is very unique for a federal appellate judge to call someone back who left a message. Long and short of it is that when the judge called back, he left a message for Ms. Lopez to return the call with instructions as to, you know, what was the purpose for the call. Well, Ms. Lopez ended up talking to Judge Hartz's judicial assistant, who stated that when they are done with cases, that those files are sent back to Denver. So, again, Judge Hartz is located in New Mexico. The 10th Circuit is in Denver. And she said that when those cases are done, they're sent back to Denver. And she basically also stated, or she gave her a phone number as to who to contact in Denver to follow up on it. So at that time, Ms. Lopez called the clerk's office in Denver, and they stated that no decision had been made. And then a follow-up story that we found was that the case was with the writing judge. Now, here's the breaking news, Eutrice. Yesterday, Ms. Lopez called Judge Hart's judicial assistant again, and the judicial assistant's name was Claudette. So anyway, she spoke to Claudette, and Claudette again referred her back to the Denver office. In this situation, we find out after Ms. Lopez speaks to the chief clerk, Mr. Klesser, he states that they received the files back from Judge Hartz's office in May of 2013. That's almost a year ago, Eutrice.
Wow.
And so if Judge Hartz's office is saying that they were done, how can a judge be done, send the files back? They've been there since May of 2013. What is going on? So you have all kinds of stories that have changed to the fact that to the point that no decision has been made. Then it's, oh, it's with the writing judge. Oh, now files have been there since May of 2013.
Okay, the implication is
frustration associated with this, and this just begs for an investigation by the Department of Justice. It just begs for it.
Cliff Stewart, your brother, as a matter of fact, is on the line. Your brother is in prison. You have a special interest in this case. Could you talk about what the impact of the case has been to the family and to the workers at IRP?
Well, yes, Clint Stewart is my brother, and the other individuals of the IRP 6, I mean, I've been known each of them for at least 20 years. Kim Barnes was my college roommate, went to high school with Demetrius Harper. Dave Banks and Gary Walker are my brother-in-laws. And David Zerpolo I've been knowing for at least 20 years. So I do consider them all my brothers. We are in constant contact with all of the families. We are a very close-knit group. And when you look at what this whole situation has done. I mean, these are men that, first off, you know, are family men, are Christian men. They're very active in their community and their church. They teach their children that, you know, this is the way to live your life. You do what's right. You work hard. If you have a product that is worthy for the market, you market it. It goes out there. It goes up against the competition. And if it's the best thing out there, it will be proven, and you can make a profit from it and also help. Like in the case of IRP Solutions, software, you can help your country. I mean, these are patriotic men. So when you see that, you know, now their children are looking and asking, you know, well, Dad, this is how you taught me. This is what you said would happen if I did what was right. How is it that you set out to help your country? You set out to provide something for our government, and this is the reward that you get. They've locked you up in prison, told you you'll be there from 7 to 11 years. We're fighting the fight to get them out. But, you know, what do you tell the children now? How do you deal with the families when they watch the corruption of Judge Christine Arguello? They watch the corruption of Assistant U.S. Attorney Matthew Kirsch, of the court reporter Darlene Martinez, who is refusing to release the unedited transcript. They watch all these things in the judicial process, and then they hear on the news that, you know, well, America has the best judicial system, you know, in the whole world. Eric Holder says it's broken, but it's still the best. I mean, the oxymoron in the purest and rawest form of its definition. How do you have something that's broken, but it's the best? I mean, it doesn't work. It's useless. It incarcerates men that and women that should not be there, but it's the best that there is. That is a sickening statement. And we have a just cause, not only for the IRP6, but for everybody who has been wrongfully incarcerated. We're fighting the fight for them because we see that that's what it takes. Once you've been incarcerated, your voice goes silent because for the most part, the entire, you know, public feels that you were convicted. The government brought a charge against you, and the reason you were convicted is because you deserved it. But as Attorney Solomon had spoke before we got on the line, she said that she saw these acts in the courtroom where the judge didn't allow evidence that would have proven that what the IRP6 was saying was true, and that there was misconduct by Assistant U.S. Attorney Matthew Kirsch. And when you look at all this, you compile it together, and you know, you say, what can you tell our children, our families, except the truth that our justice system is broken, it needs to be redone, and it does not work.
What is your reaction to what Sam Thurman just related about this case having been returned approximately a year ago, and it's just sitting there without anybody pretty much acknowledging that it actually has been returned? And presumably when a judge would call or instruct that you call to get information, that would be very significant, wouldn't you say?
Yes, absolutely. And Eutrice, I think it's atrocious. You know, when I heard this information, I was sickened inside because you look at this situation, you say, here are six men incarcerated wrongfully for 20 months. There are over 200 pages of transcript missing. The appellate judges have sent their decisions back to say, I reviewed the information. I'm giving what I feel, what I feel the decision should be. You send it back to the district court to say, go ahead and release the decision. And you know, Eutrice, first off, they were very upset, the 10th Circuit of Appeals Court, up in Denver, Colorado, when Ms. Lopez called them and said that the judge had gotten back in touch with her. They questioned, why would you contact an appeals judge? How did you get his chamber number? They're very troubled by the fact that we have reached out to the judge, which, you know, kind of said you usually don't get troubled about somebody being contacted unless you're hiding something. And then on the second part of that is, if the appeal had been favorable to the government, do you not think that information would have immediately been available if the appellate judges would have said, we withhold this conviction, these men committed crime, and they should be spending time in prison? That decision would have immediately been given out, would have been provided to all of the attorneys, would have been a press release, with all of the information and all of the press releases that a Just Cause has been doing, you know the government would have loved to have said the appellate judges have come back and said that a Just Cause is wrong, these men deserve to be in prison. But the fact that they have not released the opinions of the appellate judges tells us that it had to be a favorable decision for the IRP 6. But instead of them doing the right thing, they sit on it for over a year. We talked to the former Ohio Attorney General Petro. He told us, when we laid out this case to him, told him just the one issue that's on appeal, that there's over 200 pages of missing transcripts. He said when an appellate court sees something like that, you're talking about a matter of a few weeks before they return their decision on that, saying, if we do not have the entire record, how can we make a decision? And just like Attorney Solomon said, she said everything was returned in March. And then you see that by May, it was sent back to the 10th Circuit. So they got it in less than two months, which basically aligns with what Attorney General Petro said, that, hey, in a few weeks they returned that back saying there's no way we can do anything with this. You need to reverse this. You need to let these men out, throw this case out. But instead they have been sitting on it for almost an entire year.
Just so you know, I also called, and I talked with Mr. Kressler and directly, and he said to me that the case is pending before the court. That was the official status that he gave the case. And I said, is it going to be taking that long? Because it did seem a very long time to be for a case to be submitted for review and still be pending. And he said, yes, it's taken that long. I talked with him, and that's what he said. I just wanted your audience to know you can call in with your questions, 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888, as we proceed with this discussion. Sam Thurman, Mark Garagos has taken an interest in this case. If people don't know who he is, he's a very high-profile attorney, has handled some of the more some very noteworthy cases. How did he get on this case?
Well, initially got on the case through a Just Cause reaching out and basically canvassing for attorneys to assist in this matter. We've mentioned Ms. Lopez earlier. Ms. Lopez is in charge of our media outreach team, as well as affiliate relations and so forth. And she just beats the bushes. And she managed, this was last year sometime, managed to reach out to Mr. Garagos' office. And late last summer, Cliff and I, along with Ms. Lopez and Attorney Solomon, went and met with Mark, Mr. Garagos, as well as Tina Glandian and Garagos and Garagos. And, Mark stated at that time that, and he stated since then, that in his over 30 years of practice, he has never, ever seen some of the things that this case has presented. You will see Mr. Garagos quoted in certain articles where he says that, he fights for the underdog, and that he likes to go after cases where people have been wronged. And when he looked at this, he saw the atrocities, and then also he said, he's come to a point in his career where he can pick and choose what cases he wants. And he was just intrigued. I think that one of the words that he used was he was aghast at what he saw in this case. And so, we're fortunate to have Mr. Garagos on the team, obviously. And they are doing, going head-to-head with the assistant U.S. attorney on the lawsuit regarding the 200 pages of missing transcript, or actually over 200 pages of missing transcript. And then also, Mr. Garagos is representing the IRP 6 themselves as well in part of that appeal.
What has become of Investigative Resource Planning Solutions, Inc., IRP?
As far as Investigative Resources Planning, IRP Solutions, the company is no longer marketing the software. Obviously, I think we may have talked about this briefly on one of the previous shows, where the federal government and Assistant U.S. Attorney Matthew Kirsch put together what would appear to be a strategy to blackball not only the IRP-6, but also the company itself. So IRP Solutions was put in a position where wherever the company went to market the software, the government would come behind and present information that says that this company is either under investigation or the executives are about to be indicted or something to that effect. Even so much so that the executives of IRP Solutions ended up having to go back into the, quote, work space and go back into what they did previously. I mean, they were all very, very sought-after consultants. And so all of the executives went back into being consultants. However, and I will place a caveat there, is the fact that the federal government blackballed them in the consulting industry. Susan Holland of ETI, the one of the staffing companies that was at the root of this issue, she also blackballed them on the internet. So there was the means by which to generate revenue on the part of the company was sabotaged. The means by which the individuals, the IRP-6, Gary Walker, David Banks, Dave Zappolo, Clinton Stewart, Demetrius Harper, and Kendrick Barnes, for them to be able to make a livelihood for their families, that was also sabotaged because they were blackballed.
What, as we are actually closing out today, what I call a thorough understanding of the case. But I wanted to know, what have you learned about the intent of the prosecution? What forms your opinion now as you look at the way things have unfolded? What conclusions did you come to about why this all happened in the first place? Sam?
This is Cliff, and before I answer that part, I would like to add to what Sam has said, you know, about IRP Solutions and the Silk software. Just as an addition, you know, the Silk software is still in hand. Like he said, it's not being marketed by IRP Solutions as such. It is, it still exists. It is about 5 times more robust than what it was back when the raid of IRP Solutions had. That software is Gary's brainchild. It is his dream to provide it, to not only, you know, our government, but this software can work worldwide to help law enforcement in their case investigations and not as a software. You know, we hear a lot in the news about, you know, the government spying on people, destroying lives, sending out drones. That's not what the Silk software is for. The software is to help save lives. It's to help disseminate information about cases that law enforcement is already working on. It's so that these agencies can share information about criminal activity that is being watched. And so, but that software is, I mean, it's something that can be used worldwide. And as Sam stated, you know, even when we went outside of the U.S. and marketed, the U.S. government came behind us. But I wanted to make sure that your audience knows the software is still, you know, quote unquote, alive and kicking. But our focus right now is to get these men, our brothers, you know, out of the federal prison so that they can come out and be the ones to take this software and present it to who it needs to be presented to. But as far as what we look at, as far as the judicial process, how all of this went down, the reason that IRP Solutions was attacked, and, you know, we spoke on your show previously and actually had one of your callers who called in who used to deal with government software, and he was stating how, you know, these other large government contractors, how they will basically go out and try to steal software from the smaller competitors and basically put them underfoot, so that portion of the money is not given to anyone but these large contractors. And that is, one of the bases of what we feel has gone on in this situation, is that these large companies, and when I say large, I'm talking Fortune 5, IBM, Motorola, SAIC, Lockheed Martin, who, you know, those names are also the ones that the government contracted to actually provide software that was a competition for Silk, to the tune of $1.4 billion of taxpayer money that has been squandered and lost and wasted, and there is no case management software that the government uses after wasting all of that money. And we look at it that the competition came after IRP Solutions. We were, naive about as how big the sharks were in this ocean that we were swimming in. And now we have learned, but our biggest, shock, I guess you could say, and disappointment would be the best word to use, is how our federal so-called judicial system can take corporate debt and criminalize that and put men in prison and tell them they will be there anywhere from 7 to 11 years because they went into debt trying to bring to fruition their dream of helping their country.
Sam, what would you say you have learned or has been solidified in your mind about what the impetus was? Are you more concrete about it? And what is your conclusion about what started this whole thing in the first place?
Well, I think Cliff gave some very pointed items regarding that, in the sense that, you know, we're talking about an industry that, and as Cliff has talked on previous programs, that the failed initiatives alone accounted for over $1 billion in revenue to someone. I mean, you got SAIC that was part of one of the failed initiatives. You have Lockheed Martin, who is part of another. And so when you look at that type of money on the table, there is definitely some money motivation there. I believe that also you have to look at the fact that when, as Cliff indicated, when you take corporate debt and criminalize it, then that is just kind of taking the judicial system and doing with whatever you want. We've spoken to former investigators and U.S. Marshals and folks who've been involved in interdiction programs and raids and so forth, who have shared stories with us. And they actually stated that, you know, that they have powwows and they know what they're coming up against, they being the federal government agencies, law enforcement agencies. They know what they're coming up after against, and they're not going to go after the big guys. We already know that in the banking and finance industry, it's been stated that the banking system is too large to fail. It would have a trickle effect in our economy. So they're not going after those folks. But when they come after a small business like IRP Solutions, they know what they're going after, and they go after it with everything that they have. You used the word intent when you posed this question. And I would have to also just kind of put a different spin on that, in the sense that even from a prosecutorial perspective in trial, the basis of intent, IRP Solutions was not allowed, the IRP 6 were not allowed to establish their intent with the jury. Judge Christian Arguello, as part of the jury instructions, did not allow them to go down that road. which is a basis for determining guilt in this type of situation. Was there any intent to the fraud? Was there any intent? I mean, did you set out to establish a fraud? None of that exists. There's all the evidence exists that shows that IRP Solutions was a legitimate business developing viable software that was needed, and all the evidence is there to show that. So when you talk about intent, there was never intent, any intent on the part of IRP Solutions. It was corporate business debt, a normal business doing normal business with agencies that got criminalized.
Well, Cliff, you mentioned that the software not only does it continue to exist, but it is more robust in form. Let's suppose that, you know, there's a determination that the case was really poorly handled, and the IRP6 are vindicated, they are free to go, and they return to business. Do you think that the firm, having been besmirched this way and having suffered this kind of a concentrated attack, in terms of, you know, ruining its reputation in the field, does it have a chance of survival as IRP?
I would say that it absolutely does, because when you look at the way that they try to ruin a company's name or men's reputation, they do it with propaganda. They, you know, put out a press release. They, you know, carry around an article from one place to another. They call up places and say, you know, these are the people you're dealing with. They're under investigation, this and that. So they use propaganda. Our weapon is the truth. And the truth is what will vindicate these men, and the truth is what will win out in the end. And when they get out and go to market the software again, that's what they'll have at their disposal. Is, you know, if a question comes up, well, you know, you guys went through this, what happened? Just telling the story and what the truth is and laying the evidence out on the table to anyone, just like yourself, Utrice. You know, when you looked at it, you said, this is an atrocity. It is blatant that so many things not went wrong, but were done wrong in this situation by the parties involved in the federal government, that anyone looking at it can say this, there, that basically there's crimes that happened here, not on the part of the IRP6, but on part of the judicial system, the judge and the assistant U.S. attorney, Matthew Kirsch. And so when you lay the truth out on the table, you cannot do anything against it. It bears out only what it is, and you don't need to add anything to it. You can't take away anything. So that is what will help the IRP6 when they get out, to continue to push their software. And like I said, you know, America is not the only place that has the need of these type of solutions. And it's sad to say, but it is true. But seemingly other countries, you know, are more appreciative of the type of solutions and the type of talent that we have here. They're more appreciative than the U.S. government is, and I think that is sad. You know, do I love my country? Absolutely. Do I realize that part of it is corrupt? Again, absolutely.
And Utrice, if I may add to what Cliff was just stating, even with regard to the Silk software, you know, that software, as Cliff was stating, is so robust. And because of the fact that no one has been able to develop anything like that, as evidenced by the failed initiatives that we've spoken of before, just as, you know, several years ago, pre-FBI raid, when all of the major corporations were courting IRP Solutions to try and get teaming agreements and wanted to partner with them because they knew that IRP had the solution. That type of thing, once this cloud is removed, that type of thing will come around again. And, you know, A note on that, however, is, like you said, what have we learned? I mean, you learn, be careful who you're entertaining those types of offers from, which Gary and David were already doing that. We understand that these companies are sharks, like Cliff said, and they are going to come after you, and they're going to try and steal your software. But the product in and of itself is so strong that's all that people are going to care about. They want to get that type of solution. Law enforcement needs it, and it will solve a lot of problems within our law enforcement area.
So definitively, did the FBI itself want your software? Do you believe that? Was the FBI, in fact, conducting a raid in behalf of your competition to stage a raid, to put their hands on your software and share it with the person or company that basically wanted it? What exactly is the definitive conclusion here about this raid?
Well, Utrecht, you know, when you look at the evidence of on February 9, 2005, how the FBI came in and with a warrant that cited that they were there for financial records, yet they proceeded to image all of the computers that were in IRP Solutions offices, even going to the extent of imaging and copying, if you will, for the listeners who may not be familiar with the term imaging, but copying all of the data off of the main servers in the building as well. You have to look at that, and you have to say something was going on there. And then it's not like this kind of thing has not happened before. We've gotten email from folks, and we have been in contact even with folks on Capitol Hill who were involved in inquiries of similar matters. If your listeners were to go out and do research on a company called Enslaw, the parallels are just staggering. So, you know, we look at this thing and we say, you know, you have to acknowledge the fact that you were naive to how the judicial process works, how the system works. But once you're thrust into the middle of something like this and you begin to do a lot of research, you read a lot. And when you see, again, companies like Enslaw were subjected to very, very similar activities, and then you look at IRP Solutions, it's not far-fetched, and we're not just kind of what-ifing as we talk about the different things that occurred in this case. Folks can go out to www.freetheirp6, that's the number 6, freetheirp6.org, and they can read about it for themselves and do additional research, and they will see that, wow, this is really, really over the top.
Cliff Stewart, what do you say? What was the impetus for the raid? What conclusion, definitive conclusion, have you come to about what started this which is the raid?
I would say, you know, when you look at the year of 2005 when the raid happened, that is the same year and also within weeks of the time that former Director Mueller of the FBI had to stand before Congress and give an account to where $500 million went. That was paid to SAIC for their virtual case file software that was supposed to be developed. So you have that, and then you have the fact that IRP Solutions was marketing to the FBI and DOJ as one of its potential clients. So I look at it and see, hey, the FBI is being laid out before the country. They're being scalded. They're getting a public lashing, and here they have software that does what they need done that the virtual case file system could not do. They've already spent $500 million. They can't go back and say we need more money right now to get the solution that we need to implement. So I would say yes, they came to steal the software for their own use. to, and as Sam mentioned, Enslaw. In Enslaw's case, the government did the same thing and then also sold the software to bring in money to the FBI. And so I say that, yes, it's the same situation. They came in to steal the software. And that is not just my opinion, but I use the fact that when they were supposed to take financial records, they came in and copied all of the software engineering information, all of the documentation that the developers had. And so I hold to what I stated in the previous show, that they came to steal the software. They may have used Susan Holland of ETI Professionals. They may have used Greg Goldberg of Holland and Hart Law Firm, who used to be an assistant U.S. attorney and worked with assistant U.S. attorney Matthew Kirsch, who prosecuted the case. He also worked with Judge Christine Arguello, who is the judge who presided over the case. So when you have all these connections, all these friends calling in favors, and then you have the FBI going outside of their jurisdiction, doing things that they should not do, pulling a raid on a company that they claim did not have software, when prior to the raid, it was proven that they did. So I say they tried to steal the software. And just to clear something up, Utrice, when I was saying that the Silk software would be, you know, basically marketed to other countries, I'm talking about countries who are our allies, friendly countries. I absolutely do not want your audience to believe that we would be giving any enemies of our country any type of advantage over us.
Well, gentlemen, it has been quite a ride getting this tour of a most unusual case that points up the conduct of the government at many levels, in terms of the FBI, in terms of the court and the prosecution of this case. And all the more, I'm convinced that there is extraordinary wrongdoing in this case. And my hope is that the IRP6 will find themselves vindicated very soon. We will be, of course, following the case, and of course I'll be in touch to find out what is happening, and we will come back as situation warrants. But I want to thank you for allowing us to understand this case as thoroughly as you have, and others have allowed us to understand this case. And the significance of this case is that, you know, there are excesses and violations of people's rights here by systems that are seemingly unchecked. And the question is, if it could happen to you, it certainly could happen to a whole bunch of other folks, that at the arbitrary will, people could find themselves under intense scrutiny and even prosecution and even conviction for something they had nothing to do with. So I want to thank you so much for this case. For those of you listening, you can go to the podcast and find out, take a look at the previous programs we have done about this case to get a very deep understanding. But it is there, it is on the record that this case has been looked at. And I want to thank you so much, Sam Thurman and Cliff Stewart, today. Thank you.